Good morning, and welcome to this month's Hancock Horizon Investments Economic Update call. Hancock Horizon Investments provides this call as a monthly economic update for general informational purposes only. Information provided during the call is not intended to be investment advice. Opinions are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of Hancock Holding Company or its affiliates. If you have any questions, please email them to richard.chauvin@hancockwhitney.com, and he'll take them at the end of the call. On today's call, we have Chief Investment Strategist John Portwood, Investment Director Greg Hodleski, Jeffrey Tangus, and Richard Chauvin, who will be the moderator. And with that, Richard, I'll pass it on to you.
Thank you, Ashley, and good morning, everyone, and welcome to our March Economic Update call. I'll set the stage for our discussion this morning by mentioning a few items. First, we'll note that both strong consumer and business sentiment has been really instrumental in driving this equity market since the election in November. The U.S. equity market is up around 11% since the election, yet there remains lots of uncertainty about what fiscal policies will end up being enacted by this Congress and signed by this administration. The chance for investors to be disappointed by the turn of events that roll out as 2017 progresses seems rather high, particularly since the price-earnings ratio of this market is about 18 times forecast earnings, which is a level we've not seen since back in 2002. So we have some concerns that the market could be vulnerable to a correction. We have no real insight on timing of that, however. A couple of items I'll mention is that we're now seeing some evidence that investors are beginning to brace for an increase in equity volatility, and that has been quite low in this market for months, both before and after the election. We've had very, very low levels of equity volatility. We're also seeing some indication that defensive stocks, such as utilities and consumer staples, are beginning to outperform cyclical stocks, and that is a reversal of what we saw in the period before the election and immediately after the election. So with that, we have to wonder what's in store for investors as 2017 progresses. And with that, I'll turn the floor over to John Portwood to discuss some of the fiscal policy proposals and what implications they may have for the markets and the economy. John, tell us what you think is going on and what might be developing in regard to those areas.
Yeah, thanks, Richard. Let me mention a few things about what the current economic situation looks like. The leading indicators seem to look okay. We'll get some new data on that in a week or so. But the last time the numbers came out, no recession was in store, at least not on the immediate horizon. And the coincident indicators that we look at currently suggest that, you know, we're in the midst of a moderate growth period, and that's what the Fed's beige book, the Federal Reserve book that they get from various regions around the country, has indicated most recently. So it seems like, you know, the moderate growth path that we've been on is going to continue for a while. There's been a lot of worry about inflation. However, data we're receiving from various sources indicate that companies have relatively limited pricing power, and there's no correlation among the different items that are used in calculating the price increases for the CPI. So it doesn't suggest that we've got a broad-based rise in inflation underway, at least not yet. I mean, two or three years from now, or maybe longer, who knows what we'll get. But right now, it looks like inflation is not really an immediate concern. But getting into some specific, I guess, some detailed information on where we are in the economy, we're seeing some late cycle stuff popping up. For example, bank loan demand growth is slowing. Banks are tightening credit conditions, particularly on commercial real estate and auto loans. And we're seeing some other areas of the economy that are not faring that well. Farmland peaked in price a couple of years ago. We talked about that in the past. Now you've got a situation where farm income is low, debt's relatively high, and crop crops are abundant. So we're not getting much from the farm section either. And around the world, you're seeing expensive real estate peaking in just about every large city from London to Singapore. So it appears that, you know, while moderate growth is the best guess here and, say, you know, globally and in Europe and so forth, it's not particularly robust and probably subject to being perhaps, you know, later this year weaker than we might anticipate. But that gives you kind of a background of where we are. And in the midst of that, of course, we've got this plan to use some, you know, tax reform, infrastructure spending, and deregulation to goose growth in the U.S. to some degree. And all of that could lead to some better things down the road. But unfortunately, you know, getting from here to there might be difficult. Some of you may be aware that the changes to the Obamacare Affordable Care Act have been put forth by the Republicans. Unfortunately, cost and coverage estimates weren't mentioned, and how to pay for it is a big question. And some people are suggesting that in the final analysis, it's going to be just about as expensive as the original Obamacare. But I guess we just have to figure out, you know, how that's going to work out. And of course, there's going to be a considerable amount of discussion and perhaps fighting over this over the plans for changes in medical care. In terms of the other plans, infrastructure spending and tax reform is now projected to be perhaps a year or so out before any plan is put on the table. The initial plan called for something that was called a border adjustment tax to pay for all of this spending and keep, you know, tax receipts to the government neutral. But that appears to be in some trouble. And what the border adjustment tax would do, in just simple terms, it would favor exports over imports and might cost companies a great deal of money who are importing goods and parts and so forth to manufacture things or sell things in the U.S. And you know, there's quite a bit of concern that things might not even out as fast as might be desirable for you know, a tax change like that to be implemented. So that seems to be, you know, a factor that might reduce, I guess, the tax plan to something that's more ordinary that might have, you know, less impact going forward. Infrastructure spending, well, in the past, that hasn't had a very good track record in the U.S. We end up with a lot of things that cost money but don't really produce any income or really improve productivity. So that remains a question mark. Deregulation, almost everybody believes, will be more positive in the long run. But again, with deregulation, long run makes more sense. With infrastructure and tax reform, if you look back historically, it takes a while for those things to have any impact. So the implication for the economy is that probably, unless something significant happens globally, the immediate impact of any changes in infrastructure spending, tax reform, or so forth will be moderate. It'll take some time before that works through the economy, assuming that it, you know, they do have the anticipated impact. And as far as the markets, yeah, Richard, you just talked about those. The markets are probably anticipated more than will be delivered immediately by changes in the tax code or infrastructure spending. So, well, one other thing I might mention here while we're talking about the economy that's, you know, relatively moderate and you got some headwinds. Some monetary tightening apparently is already underway. We've got some information indicating the Fed has already started by simply letting excess reserves, which are available for bank lending, to fall. And they're talking about rising, you know, raising interest rates again, maybe to, you know, get a jump on fiscal spending. Who knows? But in any case, you've got the prospect of monetary tightening, you know, in the face of very moderate growth. You normally don't see that, but again, that may be connected to what the plans are for infrastructure spending. So it's a confusing situation, and there's really no way to predict exactly where this is going to go. But later rather than sooner is probably a pretty good guess in terms of the impact for changes in fiscal spending.
John, to follow up with that, you know, that's a pretty heavy agenda that we knew would, you know, challenge the administration in the first 100 days and beyond. How do you see this rather high level of partisanship and rancor that's going on in Washington impacting the administration's ability to work these policy prescriptions through the Congress? It wouldn't seem to be any help at all in that regard.
That's probably an understatement. We all knew that there would be no kissing and making up after this election. We talked about that before Election Day. This has turned out to be probably worse than almost anyone predicted. And the political war now, you know, based on, you know, comments over the weekend, certainly has now reached a fever pitch. And historically, not much gets done in Congress when an environment like this exists. So that's certainly going to slow down the process. It may not stop it completely, but it probably is going to have a pretty good impact on things as we move along. So, and unfortunately, there's no prospect that the political war is going to end anytime soon. So things are probably going to be drawn out for quite some time.
Thank you, John. Appreciate those comments. Turning to Greg now, despite all that's been going on in Washington, we've had a pretty good equity market. Greg, why don't you tell us about what you've seen happening in the recent month and even further back, and what you might foresee in stocks at this point.
All right. Good morning, everyone. Yeah, absolutely. February was another good month for the U.S. markets as well as the international markets. Those were pretty much positive across the board also. The trend we saw in late last year where the smaller cap stocks were the clear winners, with the mid-capitalization stocks coming in second and finally large caps at the trailing end, reversed itself in January, as I think we mentioned in our January call, or February call, I should say. In January, large caps actually became the winners, and with mid-caps following next and small caps turning in a negative monthly performance during January. February was no exception to the trend. It continued with larger stock issues beating smaller stock issues. For the month, the Dow Jones Industrial Average posted a positive 5.2% return. The widely followed S&P 500 index ended up 4% for the month, followed by the S&P Mid-Cap 400 posting a 2.6% return. And finally, the S&P Small Cap 600 index coming in with a positive 1.6% return for the month. The positive return posted by the small cap index was a reversal from the January negative performance. A negative month for small caps in January, though, was not particularly surprising or unusual given their strong performance at the end of last year. Turning to the sector economic performance, the best performing area last month was healthcare. It turned in a strong 6.4% return, followed up by utilities up 5.3%, and financials up 5.2%. Both of those areas, and you alluded to strength in those areas, continue to see inflows of cash. With their generally higher level of dividend income, investors who are seeking more income-oriented areas of the stock market are gravitating towards utilities and financials. And so if you look at stocks that have that attribute of higher dividends relative to the rest of the stocks in the indexes, you're seeing strong positive cash flows there. Excuse me. The next was information technology. That came in at producing a 5.1% return, followed by consumer staples at 5%. Then the newly created real estate sector came in at 4.7%. Next, industrials were up 3.8%, followed by consumer discretionary at 2%, and finally materials stocks up 0.7%. The only two sectors producing a negative return for the month were telecom services, down a minus 0.4%, and energy, a negative minus 2.2%. Again, overall, a very strong month for the U.S. markets. In terms of the international markets, we saw the S&P develop, and this is ex-U.S. stocks, of course, up 1.42 for the month. Emerging markets, another strong showing, up 3.46% for the month. So, again, international, and just out of the dashboard that I'm looking at, I think there was only one international market that was actually negative. And just looking at U.S. markets again to wrap up, year-to-date, if you look at the returns, again, through February 28th, the Dow is up 5.8%, S&P 500 up 5.9%, mid-caps up 4.3%, small caps up about 1.2%. So overall, again, stocks seem to be very strong, and it seems to be a very broad-based movement in stocks. Again, I think I mentioned some caution. Perhaps the market has gotten ahead of itself a little bit based a lot on expectations, and hopefully policy isn't delayed and those expectations are fulfilled. But as mentioned before, it wouldn't be unusual if we do have a bit of a pullback somewhere along the way. And that's a little wrap up, I guess.
Thank you, Greg. Appreciate those comments and agreed that we've had a great start to the year. That's usually a good precursor to a positive year, but a lot ahead of us here. Turning now to Jeff Tangus, fixed income portfolio management head. Jeff, what's been going on in the bond market and particularly with regard to monetary policy?
Well, we've had a lot take place since we met last month. I'll start with just a quick update on the bond market because for the month of February, rates had not moved that much. So we'll go ahead and cover that quickly and then move on to the Fed. During the month of February, as I say, things continued to be fairly quiet. Two-year government bond yields were up only 5 basis points, essentially unchanged to 1.25%. As we sit here today with some of the news that's taken place since the end of the month, they're up again to about 1.32, but for the month of February, it was fairly quiet. The 10-year was actually down in yield during the month of February slightly, about 6 basis points, but also like the 2-year, since the end of February, rates have moved up on the 10-year to about 2.5% now, which is kind of in the middle to the upper end of the range that the 10-year has been trading with. So not a lot, even as we sit here today, rates haven't changed that dramatically. Spreads, corporate bonds, for example, rates did not rise nearly as much. So corporate bond spreads have actually narrowed. I think everybody is still sitting on the sidelines waiting to see what action the Fed takes when they meet on March 14th and 15th. As we sit here today, the market voting machine, the Fed funds probability, is at a 98% probability that the Fed raises another 25 basis points in their March 14th and 15th meeting. And that's a pretty big change. Until the middle of last month, it was well under 50%. So what happened to cause that change? A chorus of Fed governors have come out and said that, the Fed, we've reached our full employment goal, one of their mandates. Inflation, as John Portwood pointed out earlier, is very low by historical standards, right at 2%. But that's kind of been the Fed's target. So the Fed thinks in its collective wisdom that it's met the inflation target that it's looking for. So given those two facts, the Fed has recently become much more vocal about wanting to normalize their term interest rates. And I think that's probably the most important point of all this is people who would look at the Fed and say, I don't understand why the Fed is raising rates. I mean, the economy is still very is growing still in that 2% range. There doesn't seem to be much of a case to be made there. But the Fed isn't so much looking at that as they want to normalize rates. They want to get out of this stimulative mode that they've been in really since the Great Recession of 2007. So we need to quit looking at it in terms of, well, is inflation running away or is growth really starting to take off? And just looking at it from the perspective that the Fed wants to, is at this point, continues to be manipulative in terms of rates. And the Fed wants to move back to a market mechanism where the markets set rates more so than just the Federal Reserve. I would also remind listeners that sometimes we talk about the Fed and it's sort of clinical sounding. What the Fed does is important because it really filters through the markets and sets the bank prime lending rate. The prime lending rate moves almost lockstep with the Fed funds rate, although at a higher rate. The prime rate, of course, being the best rate that banks charge their best customers on loans. So as they raise interest rates, as the Fed raises interest rates, that transfers into the prime lending rate also. So where we sit now, if we look at what the market is expecting, it's almost a given. The Fed gets a free pass on this March. At this point, the markets are almost begging the Fed to raise rates with a 98% probability. They can raise rates with actually nobody will be surprised, and that's the Goldilocks scenario for the bank. It also appears that the market believes the Fed is likely to raise again in July and likely to raise again in December. As we came into this year, the Fed threw their what they call the dot plot, where they sort of anonymously forecast what they think rates are going to do. Each one of the Fed governors does this. Collectively, they said that they thought they would be raising three times this year. Now, they always, in years past, have forecasted higher numbers than they actually ended up enacting. But it looks like the market at this point at least believes it. So barring any surprise in the economy, it appears that the Fed is on track to raise rates two more times this year, once in July and once in December. So this year will be quite a bit different than years past, where they've only raised once and they raised it in December right as the clock struck midnight, so they could say that they could check that box of raising rates in 2016 and 2017. But it appears that this year is going to be considerably different, and it's it appears that that's because the economy can withstand some rate increases to some degree. Now, others on our team have thoughts about how much, how strong the economy is and whether it, how much it will be able to withstand two or three rate increases. It'll certainly take some wind out of the sails, but that may be counteracted by some of the pro-growth policies of the current administration. But it looks like this year is going to be considerably different, and I would urge our listeners just to watch closely, because I think the Fed will have a big hand in what takes place with interest rates this year.
Thank you, Jeff. I do have a couple of questions. They're related from the audience, and I'm going to ask John Portwood if he will take the first crack at these questions. The question really involves the impact on the national debt from the interest rate increases that the Federal Reserve is enacting, has been acting, and is expected to continue to enact. So the first part of the question is, what impact will this increase in interest rates have on servicing the national debt? And the related question to that is, what impact might that, what might these interest rate increases have on the inflation rate going forward? John, do you have any thoughts on those questions?
On the first one, I have seen a lot of math dedicated to that subject. The number I remember, and this may include Treasury debt as well as corporate debt, and I'm not really sure, but something like, gosh, I'm trying to remember the number, a lot of debt resets in the next 2 or 3 years. And I can't remember the exact number, but it could have a fairly significant impact if rates stay where they are. And I'm trying to think of the interest cost. The figure $200 billion a year sticks in my mind. It would add to interest cost. And I don't know if that's all federal or if it's system-wide. My guess is it might be a system-wide number, but that's already there. I mean, it's already in interest rates that exist today. So if interest rates rise much beyond where they are today, then that's obviously going to have a big impact on debt payments down the road. The other question was, what does that do to inflation? I tend to agree with the economist who, particularly Lacey Hunt at Hodgson, who writes quite a bit about this, that we're in an asymmetric world where debt levels are so high, it doesn't take much of a rise in interest rates to impact the economy. So my guess would be if interest rates rise a great deal more than anyone anticipates currently, and say more than even maybe the Fed anticipates currently, it's going to have an impact on economic growth, and the impact may begin fairly early in the game if indeed we do end up, we are in an asymmetric type environment where changes in interest rates, even small changes, have a bigger impact on the economy than low interest rates. And we know that, you know, the Fed has been basically unsuccessful in generating a high growth situation or a good recovery despite all of the quantitative easing they have done. That's true in Europe as well. So, you know, if that condition does exist, then it means that it won't take much to hit the economy a bit. So my guess is that interest rates, unless we get into a generalized inflation situation where everybody joins the party and everybody starts borrowing and spending again and buying every asset they can because things are turning into runaway inflation, I don't think we're going to get a whole lot of change in interest rates because the economy is going to get knocked back before that happens.
Yeah, and John, just to add to that, there's some argument that, you know, increased debt and I guess an increased interest servicing cost on debt could be viewed as deflationary because they do impact economic growth rather than inflationary. So at some level, that's probably the case, and that's actually the sort of the debt super cycle argument that many, not many, but some economists have made. Deflationary effects sort of overwhelm inflationary effects. Okay. All right. It's almost on the half hour. I see no further questions. So with that, we will wrap up the call for this month and look forward to speaking with you next month. Our next call will be on April 4th. Thank you, everyone.